PMA Productions, White Pine Pictures, and Gebruder Beats Film Production present a Super Channel Fuse original, a Secret War documentary productions film. A man with a bowler hat walks in a city.
In 1939, Europe is at war, when an obscure Canadian businessman sets out to change the world. His name is William Stevenson, one of the 20th century's greatest spy masters, yet widely unknown.
Logs burn in a fire pit.
At the end of the Second World War, Stevenson burns all evidence of his top secret mission.
He watches the documents burn.
Or at least he thought he did. It takes decades for historians to piece together Stevenson's secret operations, designed to help bring the United States into the war.
A portrait of Winston Churchill appears.
Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
Stevenson knew that the British needed America in order to succeed in the war.
William Stevenson helped create a weapon for shaping democratic opinion.
Women cheer in the streets.
The centralized British spy agency he creates becomes a model for the United States and influences the development of the CIA.
Do we look at Stevenson as somebody who manipulated the United States to get into World War II, or do we look at him as somebody who helped to save Britain from Hitler?
This is the long-hidden story of one of the 20th century's most secret operations.
We're 80 years from these events, but they shape the secret world to this day.
A daring plan led by a man from the shadows.
A person types on the keys of a typewriter. This is Shadow Man, William Stevenson and the Art of Political Warfare. In the 30s, a man gets out of a car at night.
It's fitting that a man who lived his life in the shadows was born into them. In 1901, at age 4, a boy in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, named William Stanger gets a new identity. Almost nothing is known about his real parents. His adopted parents are called Stevenson. And with this, William Stevenson takes on his first persona.
Nicholas J. Call, professor of public diplomacy.
He seems to have worked hard to not talk about his humble origins. William Stevenson is an odd character. He leaps into public knowledge during World War I, a Canadian fighter ace on the Western Front with all kinds of heroic deeds.
In archive footage, early military airplane prototypes fly in the sky.
Those remarkable deeds include shooting down 12 German aircraft as an ace pilot in the Royal Flying Corps. Stevenson is himself shot down behind enemy lines and taken as a prisoner of war before making a daring escape in 1918.
Men waving flags celebrate in the streets. A smoking man plays a concertina.
There was to be no more war in their time or their children's time.
November 11th, 1918.
After armistice, the war hero reinvents himself for the first of many times.
Nicholas Reynolds, former CIA.
After the war, he becomes kind of one of the original transatlantic entrepreneurs. And he has, he's got a foot in Canada, and he marries an American wife, and he lives mostly in Britain, and he starts to develop various enterprises. He has initiatives varied from radio to precious metals.
Black musicians play the trumpet and the trombone. A row of flappers dance in a speakeasy.
The 1920s famously roar, and Stevenson is one of many who makes millions off the boom. His various business enterprises take him back to Europe, where the wounds of the Great War have not healed.
People run in the streets.
So he encounters the people that are helping Germany to recover from World War I.
That was Mr. Reynolds. People in Europe fight in the streets.
Defeated Germany has no hope of rebuilding under the weight of European reparations. While the rest of the world celebrates, Germans suffer. Anger rises, and that anger is channeled through Adolf Hitler.
Hundreds gather in front of Hitler in Germany. Christy Ironside, professor of Russian history.
The Nazis come to power on this huge wave of resentment. Perception was that they had been humiliated, stabbed in the back, that they had been left to bear the costs of World War I, paying extremely steep redemption payments. They're going to regain a sense of national pride.
It's in this turbulent time that Stevenson shapeshifts once again. Gone is the Gatsby-like entrepreneur. The new Stevenson is a man of the establishment, with ties to power.
Professor Cole.
And so he's a sort of a self-invented private intelligence person with a personal network, which is of value to Britain's intelligence lineup during the early days of World War II.
The Stevenson family in Winnipeg, which gave him his first identity, have no contact with him for the rest of his life.
A train passes in front of people waiting on a platform in the 1920s.
His desire was to be a gray man, a powerful and rich, but gray man who fit into the British Empire. So he wanted to belong. And belonging for him meant denying his ancestry. He didn't really want you to understand why he made those moves. What he wanted was you to accept his version of his biography. And that was the way he approached reality. He wanted you to accept his reality. His desire to control the past ultimately meant that it controlled him.
That was Timothy Naftali, presidential historian. Nazis salute Hitler back in the 1930s. Hitler passionately delivers a speech.
By the 1930s, Stevenson focuses his intelligence gathering on the country that once held him prisoner. Hitler's Nazi movement ignites German pride and anger. He rebuilds the armed forces, defying conditions laid out after World War I.
Tanks cross a field.
In 1938, Hitler threatens to declare war on Czechoslovakia in his quest to expand the Nazi Reich. European leaders led by Great Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain step in.
Chamberlain signs a paper.
An agreement is reached in Munich in September 1938, ceding part of Czechoslovakia to Hitler in exchange for no further Nazi expansion.
September 30th, 1938.
We regard the agreement signed last night on the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
Chamberlain famously walks away from the Munich conference saying that we have achieved peace in our time. He thinks by appeasing Hitler that that would be the extent of Hitler's ambitions.
That was Shannon Nash.
No way to reconcile Hitler's appetite with British and French national interests. The British and French elites didn't understand that.
A man reads in a Parisian cafe.
Stevenson's informal intelligence gathering on Germany is now vital.
Germans salute Hitler in the street.
He is summoned to London by MI6, Britain's secret intelligence service.
Stevenson rides in a car.
Stevenson agrees to work covertly for the spy agency, gathering whatever intelligence he can on the fearsome Nazi war machine.
In archive footage, a cannon shoots at a building all the way across a field.
In September of 1939, the Nazis invade Poland. 2 days later, Britain and France declare war on Germany. The peace in our time, declared at Munich, has lasted less than a year.
It was clear that Hitler wasn't going to be satisfied with Poland, and he was looking for other areas to control. In May of 1940, the Nazis invade Western Europe.
In old-timey animation, the symbol of the swastika covers Europe in black ashes. Universal International News, yesterday's big story.
May 26, 1940, the beaches at Dunkirk and the beginning of an eight-day saga that prevented the complete annihilation of the Allied armies. In the face of a fierce Nazi onslaught, Belgium had collapsed and British and French troops were trapped in the pincers as German forces advanced relentlessly. Overnight, a flotilla...
By 1940, France is under occupation. Poland has been split between the Soviets and the Nazis. Czechoslovakia is also a protectorate. And Britain is very worried that they're going to be next. So the situation is very tense in Britain.
That was Christy Ironside.
Chamberlain resigns. First Lord of the Admiralty Winston Churchill assumes leadership of a crumbling empire at war against a fearsome enemy.
Churchill waves at onlookers.
Churchill is desperate to bring America into the war. William Stevenson has been quietly gathering information on the Nazis for years, and his moment of opportunity has arrived.
Timothy Naftali.
William Stevenson was among those who saw the Nazi threat for what it was. And as the Churchwellians gained control over the British government and over British foreign policy, clever outsiders, clever amateurs, like William Stevenson, got closer and closer to the center of power and became more and more useful.
Churchill sees in 1940 that the British can't do it alone, that they need America to come into the war at that time due to German aggression and the threats to the British homeland, as well as the threats that have carried across Europe.
Hitler shakes a soldier's hand. A man in a suit poses for a photo.
The chief of MI6, Colonel Stuart Graham Menzies, understands London needs a closer relationship in the shadows with Washington.
The British understood that J. Edgar Hoover had the ear of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and that J. Edgar Hoover was also on good terms with the State Department, and that J. Edgar Hoover was ambitious.
J. Edgar Hoover is the founding director of the FBI, the point person for all of America's domestic anti-Nazi spy activity. Menzies sends Stevenson to meet Hoover.
A ship approaches the shores of New York.
It's in the summer of 1940 that William Stevenson arrives in New York. So that's the same period. It's almost to the day when Hitler marches into Paris.
That was Mr. Reynolds.
Hoover wants to cooperate with London, but he tells Stevenson that his hands are tied without President Roosevelt's approval.
Hoover gets out of a private plane.
Menzies now names Stevenson the new head of British intelligence in America.
Couples dance in a dance hall. Some have numbers on their backs. Soldiers shoot flour at a tank in a field.
Stevenson understands the delicacy of his mission. The United States is utterly unready, and most Americans unwilling to get involved in the war.
A black couple dances.
Meanwhile, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt is engaged in a juggling act. It's a presidential election year, and he knows he can't win if he runs on a platform of getting America into the war.
A man shakes Roosevelt's hand.
FDR was an interventionist in favor of involvement with the rest of the world. He's very attuned to what his political opponents are saying, so he wants to intervene, but on the other hand, he's afraid of alienating or aggravating the isolationists. There's a deep vein of isolationism in the United States, the idea that Americans shouldn't get involved in foreign wars.
That was Mr. Reynolds.
Chief among the isolationists is an American hero. In 1927, Minnesota Airmail pilot Charles Lindbergh flies alone from New York to Paris. His daring flight catapults him into the public eye.
Lindbergh waves at a crowd.
His fame is tragically renewed when Lindbergh's 20-month-old son is kidnapped. 4 years pass before the child's killer is caught in 1936. Now the camera-shy Lindbergh is once again in the limelight, this time warning Americans to stay out of the European war.
Lindbergh talks on the radio.
These wars in Europe are not wars in which our civilization is defending itself. This is simply one more of those age-old struggles within our own family of nations. If we enter fighting for democracy abroad, we may end by losing it at home.
Lindbergh was somebody who, you know, had this very public persona as the aviator. His son was abducted, and he comes out of nowhere with these isolationist statements, which sort of shock people, right? But which were actually quite common at the time. There were a lot of Americans who supported it. Charles Lindbergh is staunchly in the isolationist camp, and he is the mouthpiece to this idea that America needs to come first.
The unknown Stevenson now faces two formidable adversaries. The world's most feared dictator.
A photo of Hitler is shown.
And America's greatest hero.
Lindbergh's photo appears.
William Stevenson recognized the power and the influence of Charles Lindbergh, and as a result, saw him as an adversary, a major adversary.
Stevenson is operating in a space where he needs to try to get America to throw its support behind Britain to make sure that Britain is not overrun by the Nazis, that it doesn't meet the same fate as France.
So the issue for Roosevelt was, if Britain collapses, what happens to their navy? Because if the Germans acquire their navy, Germany will control the Atlantic. And if Germany controls the Atlantic, well, it's not just a matter of our ships no longer being able to trade with the world. Where are the Germans going to go next? Are they going to come to our hemisphere?
On a map, the U.S. is surrounded by enemies.
Stevenson's first step is to dramatically expand British intelligence operations in the United States.
New York, July 1940.
In 1940, the U.S. is an espionage backwater.
Cars drive through crowded streets.
When Bill Stevenson arrives in the U.S., he finds that the British operation is in a small office called Passport Control, located in the Battery, right at the tip of Manhattan. And he really thinks that won't do. So initially, he moves the office into his personal quarters, sort of an uptown penthouse. Stevenson is said to have used his own resources to help things along, which certainly make things a lot easier.
The state of U.S. intelligence in 1940 is not prepossessing. There's not a whole lot going on. I like to say it's the cottage industry stage of American intelligence. There are not a lot of people. There are not a lot of resources. It's not a respected part of the U.S. government.
Stevenson's job is to liaise with J. Edgar Hoover and to establish a good working relationship between British intelligence and the FBI.
What British intelligence is playing with is the idea of getting influence on the American government through a senior government official like J. Edgar Hoover.
So this marriage is a big risk for the American government. It's not a risk for the British. They are going to do everything possible to expand the lines of communication, overt and covert, with the United States. But for Roosevelt to approve a secret relationship between the FBI and British intelligence is a big deal.
American women line up for rations. Sheldon Solomon, professor of psychology.
By the 1930s, Americans were marinating in existential anxieties. We had World War I at the same time that we had the Spanish flu. Got the Roaring Twenties creating massive degrees of economic inequality, leading up to the Great Depression. Then there's the Nazis. So I do think that that's a particularly vivid confluence of events that would contribute to massive amounts of anxiety.
The Germans are up to all kinds of things to try and encourage pro-German feeling in the United States. But particularly, they wanted to work with the German-American community, where there was a German-American Bund of people who had a close identification with the Nazis.
The American Bund is a self-generated organization that emerges in 1936. It had a major impact on American popular culture because when people wondered about the Nazi Fifth Column, they would point to these overt fascists who were dressing like Nazis, who used the Nazi salute, and were quite open about the fact that they wanted an American Reich.
The threat of a Nazi Fifth Column becomes Stevenson's new focus.
Young Nazis march in the U.S.
So the Fifth Column is the idea that we're seeing agents that are within a country ready and waiting to do things like sabotage, be part of an uprising when an army does eventually arrive, or they're there to do things that are going to cause trouble to a country and cause even more suspicion.
That was Shannon Nash.
The most dramatic expression of this American Nazism was in February of 1939, when the Bund organized a rally at Madison Square Garden.
A police officer searches the bag of a man. Rally attendees show their tickets upon entry.
Imagine a 34-foot portrait of George Washington
next to people doing the Nazi salute.
But no, my friend. The press, the radio, and the cinema are in the hand of the Jews.
A man is brutalized by Nazi sympathizers.
Those images were seared into the American popular imagination the way the images in Charlottesville seared themselves into the popular imagination. The idea that there were people who believed that there was some connection between George Washington and Adolf Hitler was shocking.
A man does a Nazi salute at a white nationalist rally in 2017. Sheldon Solomon.
When you attach yourself to a Hitler or anyone of that sort, you're basically accepting the worldview that they are presenting to you. Propagandists, particularly demagogues, they're like alchemists of hate. What they do is to transmute the fears of their followers into hatred, and that dynamic is very effective because you're giving distressed and insecure people a simple black and white worldview. We're good, they're evil, stick with me, and everything will be fine.
Hitler speaks at a rally. In a crowd, hundreds of Nazi flags are raised. In a reenactment video, a woman walks to Stevenson's desk and hands him a file.
While the British were trying to figure out what to do, the Nazis knew what they needed to do. What they want to do is find a way, subtly, to support with money isolationist opinion. The Nazis identify members of Congress who are against intervention.
Hamilton Fish, Republican congressman.
The German embassy in Washington, D.C. runs a massive propaganda campaign aimed at German Americans and other isolationists.
Hans Thompson, German embassy.
The Nazis were able to dupe some isolationist senators and members of Congress into ordering copies of isolationist propaganda and then send these not just to their constituents, but to a mailing list that was ginned up by the German Information Library, which was a Nazi organization funded by Berlin.
That was historian Timothy Naftali.
William Stevenson knows the Nazis are running a propaganda campaign in the U.S. His goal is to destroy it. Now his connections to money and power pay off.
Memorandum for Mr. Astor.
Stevenson's first big break comes in the form of critical intel from one of the richest men in America, Vincent Astor.
Timothy Naftali.
Astor and Stevenson know each other. Astor was a very important intermediary between Stevenson and FDR.
Vincent Astor is the son and heir of John Jacob Astor, who has a transatlantic fortune. Astor happens to be Roosevelt's neighbor in the upper Hudson Valley outside of New York City. Astor runs an amateur intelligence bureau. He's one of the leading members of something called The Room. The members are very prominent businessmen and politicians, and they meet and they chat about world events. Someone might take notes, type up a report, and send it to the State Department in Washington. Astor's important because he tells us about Roosevelt's approach to intelligence. What Roosevelt does is, hey, I can rely on my social circles, and they will tell me all I need to know about the world.
That was Mr. Reynolds.
Astor informs Stevenson that Dr. Gerhard Vestrick, the commercial counselor at the German embassy, is about to be the guest of honor at a private dinner hosted by Texaco. The head of Texaco, Torkild Reber, is a fascist. London has warned Stevenson to be on the lookout for Vestrick.
The CEO of Texaco is involved with Germany in various ways from an economic and business side of things. He has a history of involvement with fascist movements and fascist leaders.
So the idea that Nazi Germany is sounding out American business is very worrying to to Americans. Some in the United States could see in Vestrick's activity and in American business being prepared to talk to Vestrick as the beginnings of that kind of fifth column activity.
Stevenson opens a folder.
Stevenson's intel suggests that Reber plans to send oil to Germany, prohibited by American law. He gets to work on a dossier.
He examines two pictures.
Stevenson got data on Westrick's movements, on the source of money for his car, on his housing, on the assistance that the Texas Oil Company was giving him, and some background about the Texas oil man, Reber.
In July 1940, not satisfied to merely report to MI6 and the FBI, Stevenson decides to leak a mixture of truth and falsehood to the U.S. public. Stevenson arranges a deniable handoff to the New York Herald Tribune, the national rival of the New York Times.
They don't know that it's coming from Stevenson. They don't know that all of it's not fact, but it starts to pick up and it starts to circulate throughout the U.S. It starts to create this feeling that we need to be aware of it, we need to be worried about it. Westrick has to go, and the CEO of Texaco is deeply involved. Do we start to suspect other business people? Then we start to really see other seeds being planted by Stevenson of these fifth column fears.
Hoover was, for one reason or another, restrained about using the press against the Nazi fifth column. William Stevenson had no such qualms. Let us put it this way. It is hinted at in the surviving records from the British Security Coordination that Stevenson was doing something that Hoover wanted done, which was to use the U.S. press to make it hard for the Nazis to operate in the United States.
Americans get quite angry. There's letters, there's people showing up at Westrick's house. There's a lot of anger towards Westrick. He eventually leaves. He's recalled to Germany. A lot of this because of things that maybe were happening behind closed doors, brought to light by Stevenson through the media.
By the way, the stories that ran in the New York Herald Tribune had such an effect that there was talk of the New York Herald Tribune getting the Pulitzer Prize for this scoop. Well, it was no scoop. They were handed it by British intelligence.
Stevenson's perfectly executed operation cements his relations with the FBI as a trusted ally.
In his office, Hoover signs documents.
The FBI was very happy to see Gerhard Vestrick leave. And the FBI was very pleased that their new British friends had found a way to get the press a package of information which, for one reason or another, they didn't feel they could.
The front of the White House appears in black and white footage.
Convinced the U.S. must support Britain in a war most Americans oppose, Roosevelt turns to a man known to his friends as Wild Bill for help. William Donovan is a former war hero and New York lawyer. Like William Stevenson, he has traveled extensively in Europe. His insights are an asset to the Democrat White House, and his Republican contacts are useful.
Roosevelt sits in the Oval Office. Nicholas Reynolds.
Roosevelt's challenge was how to help the British without hurting himself politically. And some interventionist lawyers came up with an idea for him. And William Donovan was part of that.
He's a Republican, but he's an internationalist Republican. He's an Anglophile. He loves London. He loves going to the fancy hotels and the clubs and going to the country houses. And he's also a World War I hero, as are many of the members of the British elite at this time.
Stevenson recognizes that Donovan has his own relationship with Roosevelt. And more than this, that if Stevenson works with Donovan, he can enhance Donovan's value to Roosevelt, and this relationship can advance, in turn, Stevenson's own mission in the United States.
An old map of England is shown.
In July 1940, FDR sends Wild Bill Donovan to London to evaluate Britain's ability to fight Germany alone, without U.S. support.
Soldiers run towards warplanes.
When Stevenson heard that the U.S. government was sending Donovan to London, he wanted London to know this guy matters. He wanted them to take Donovan in their arms and to show Donovan as much as they thought they could.
When Donovan arrives in London, he is treated very, very well by the British government. They're not entirely sure how much of a mandate he has, but the general policy is the default setting in London is you get a halfway important American over there, you treat him really, really well. And that's what happens. He sees Churchill. He has a brief audience with the king. He meets the head of MI6.
Donovan was already thinking about world historical challenges. This was not Britain's war. This was a world war. This was a struggle for civilization. And Stevenson saw in Donovan somebody who could help in making the case for more American military assistance now.
With Donovan on his side, Stevenson turns his attention to the problem of convincing Americans that Britain will lose the war without U.S. help.
In London, a residential building collapses.
Hello, America. This is Edward Murrow speaking from London. There were more German planes over the coast of Britain today than at any time since the war began. Anti-aircraft guns were in action along the southeast coast today.
Churchill and his team want to do everything possible to change public opinion in the United States, to neutralize the isolationists, promote the interventionists, and get support from the United States. Ideally, that support would be a complete alliance. But short of that, you'll take armaments, you'll take material support.
The British have to figure out a way to get around the Neutrality Acts.
After the Nazis invade Poland in September 1939, Congress passes the last of its Neutrality Acts, permitting the sale of U.S. weapons to foreign powers, but only if they can transport them to Europe themselves.
Tanks are loaded onto boats.
British ships are now carrying American-made military and civilian supplies across the Atlantic, where German submarines are on deadly patrol. Yet most Americans perceive their country as neutral.
American Marines use binoculars at sea.
I think American neutrality was also born from this idea that, you know, Europe had these wars, but they weren't America's business. America's entry into World War I was a very polarizing thing. And so that experience of World War I being so disruptive and polarizing, I think it left a lot of people with a strong sense that there was no good reason to get involved in another war like this again.
Let all the years ahead will be
the audience applauds. Buildings in flames collapse in Europe.
You could help the British if you got something in return. The British made it clear they needed destroyers. They needed a way to protect those convoys that were sending American assistance to England.
A submarine shoots a boat.
This is a deal that gives Britain access to 40 overage American destroyers in return for access to bases located in mainly in the Caribbean. It's a great deal from the American point of view. Easy for Roosevelt to sell that to the American public. In fact, in retrospect, the destroyer for bases deal has been called the 40 ships that saved the world.
Churchill walks in the rubble of London.
Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate.
A group of men dig through the rubble.
Winston Churchill was the ideal leader to personify Britain at this difficult moment. I think one of the secrets of Winston Churchill is that he speaks intending to be overheard. He's rallying the British people, having arranged for the American public to overhear what he's doing. Churchill limits his direct appeal to the United States to this emotive phrase.
Give us the tools and we will finish the job.
Explicitly saying that Britain does not require young American men to fight, does not require young American men to die. When Churchill says this, he is not telling the truth. 4 or 5 months before in the War Cabinet, he has said explicitly there's no way for Britain to win without America joining the fighting war.
On February 24th, 2022, tanks drive on Ukrainian residential streets. A woman sits on a bench in front of an apartment building in flames.
A good example of a country that's doing that right now would be Ukraine, which has done an excellent job of dramatizing its response to the Russians. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that at some points, President Zelensky is mirroring Churchill. So Zelensky right now is saying exactly what Churchill did in early 1941. Give us the tools and we will finish the job.
Destroyer boats fill the deck of a carrier ship.
On September 3rd, 1940, 40 American destroyers leave for Britain, walking a fine line of U.S. policy. Within days, a powerful isolationist movement called America First rises in protest.
On a poster, a rocket hits the Statue of Liberty.
America First was an umbrella organization of people united in believing the United States should not engage in a second European war in the 20th century.
America First had a strange conglomeration of human beings. There were ultra-conservatives, people who later supported Senator McCarthy. There were middle-of-the-roaders. There were socialists. I was one who was drawn into the movement by my socialist friends. I thought it was possible that Germany would win. And my feeling that we had to stay out and remain strong to preserve Western civilization, that was a very, very potent feeling with me.
That was Ruth Benedict.
Now, America First ideas, the isolationist ideas, were very old and had many, many expressions in American political life.
By the fall of 1940, the American First Committee was a national movement. And its titular head was Charles Lindbergh.
Lindbergh poses for a photo in his aviator hat. 1940, U.S. presidential campaign.
American politics in 1940 plays out in some really interesting ways. Both candidates, Roosevelt and Wilkie, are wary of being identified with a new war.
The candidates wave at the crowd.
Stevenson expands his spy network. He moves his office to the prestigious Rockefeller Center.
Stevenson talks on the phone.
But he receives a stern reminder from his British superiors to not use his intelligence network to influence the upcoming American election.
He hangs up the phone and takes notes.
The Americans are suspicious of being told what to do by anybody. They do not want influence from the British or the Germans or anyone else. So Britain had a very vested interest in not wanting to influence the elections in 1940 the way that Russia influenced the elections in America in 2016. That didn't necessarily mean that they weren't looking to still keep the narrative moving towards wanting American support and needing American support.
Thousands of Americans walk in the streets.
85% of Americans are against U.S. involvement in the war.
Professor Cull.
The British see Roosevelt as being an essentially sympathetic figure, and they understand the presidential election of 1940 as being a key moment. In fact, a lot of Britain's restraint in 1940 is designed not to embarrass President Roosevelt. And there's an assumption that once Roosevelt gets reelected, then he will be able to help Britain.
Roosevelt rides in a car in the streets of a city and waves at the crowd. A man writes numbers on a big white board next to the names of each American state.
Broadway goes wild. A roaring sea of frenzied humanity shouts itself hoarse.
The results are now conclusive. Roosevelt wins.
Roosevelt wins the election by a landslide.
A variety of publications announce the election results.
Nevertheless, his goal to bring the U.S. into the war seems well beyond reach.
A crowd gathers in front of a house where Roosevelt stands.
And it's immediately after the election that you see the organizational growth of American isolation and the takeoff of the formal America First movement.
Nazi Germany continues to covertly fund some American isolationists.
A person holding a Nazi propaganda leaflet.
Stevenson wants Britain to fight back harder. And he has a plan for how Wild Bill Donovan can help him. Beginning with a trip to MI6 in London.
A man in uniform serves food to people aboard an aircraft.
So they fly on these old flying boats across the Atlantic. They can't make it all at once. They have to stop every so often to refuel. And they stop in Bermuda, and then the story goes they are weathered in, and they cannot continue on to London, which is a great opportunity for Stevenson.
Archive footage shows the streets of Bermuda.
He took advantage of the layover to give Donovan a tour of the facility in Bermuda that the FBI was already familiar with, where the British engaged in censorship, opening mail, opening diplomatic bags. It was an eye-opener for Donovan. That trip to Bermuda was like the first lesson, the first class. Stevenson was very clear to the British about what he was doing. He was telling his bosses in London, I am trying to maneuver Donovan into taking an intelligence role.
The London Bridge is raised.
By the time they reach London, the seeds of a new powerful U.S. intelligence agency have been planted. Meanwhile, Stevenson has another objective.
Timothy Naftali.
Stevenson's goal was to go and make the case in London that it was time that his organization had the right to engage in covert propaganda, in shaping American political opinion, not simply against the Nazis. He'd been allowed to do that, but in favor of intervention.
What we generally call covert action these days has to be done secretly, because if you're trying to persuade voters in America to vote in a certain way, you don't want to appear that you are a foreign power.
MI6 gives Stevenson the green light to launch a disinformation campaign against America First. His new ultra-powerful agency is renamed British Security Coordination, secretly making Stevenson the most influential spy in the Western Hemisphere.
Professor Nicholas J. Cole.
British Security Coordination is a massive operation and probably the largest operation ever directed at the United States by a foreign country, though BSC was not just responsible for the United States, it also looked down south towards Latin America. Some estimates put the number of people working for Bill Stevenson at around 1,000 employees. This is a tremendous number of people.
In early 1941, as Stevenson gathers his forces, Roosevelt comes up with another way to get around the Neutrality Act.
A picture of the White House is shown.
Roosevelt said, if your neighbor's house is on fire, shouldn't you lend them a garden hose to put it out? Of course you would. And then once they've put out the fire, they'll give you back the garden hose. Well, that's what we're going to do with Britain. Europe's on fire. We're going to lend them what they need to put that fire out. And then when they're done, they'll give it back to us.
He's understanding the need that Britain has so that Britain isn't tied down with that debt while they're in the thick of this war.
I ask this Congress for authority and for funds.
January 1941.
Sufficient to manufacture additional munitions and war supplies of many kinds to be turned over to those nations which are now in actual war. Our most useful and immediate role is to act as an arsenal for them as well as for ourselves.
Stevenson and Donovan walk outside.
Stevenson's relationship with the Republican Wild Bill Donovan pays off. Donovan secretly sells the idea to Roosevelt's Republican adversary, Wendell Willkie.
Wendell Willkie, Republican Party leader.
I believe that the least lend bill now pending before Congress, after thorough debate, should be passed. As the democratic world faces today, it's necessary to give our elected executive extraordinary powers.
Democracy. Members of Congress that supported Lend-Lease decided to make clear that this was for America, not for Britain. So they named the bill 1776, after the year America declared its independence of Great Britain. That's how this was sold.
By an overwhelming majority, Congress passed Lend-Lease, Bill number 1776, another declaration of independence, independence from tyranny, 1941 style.
Cars drive down an American residential street.
But by March 1941, only 17% of Americans support entering the war.
Roosevelt signs documents.
It seemed to American isolationists that now was the moment to resist politically. To every action, there's an opposite reaction, and America First is the reaction to actually quite small things that Roosevelt was doing to assist the Allies.
People gather in a stadium.
Once again, famed aviator Charles Lindbergh goes on the attack.
Lindbergh addresses the crowd.
There are still interests in this country and abroad who will do their utmost to draw us into war. Against these interests, we must be continuously on guard.
The interesting thing about Lindbergh is he's kind of an appealing character. You may not agree with his ideas, but it was initially very hard to dislike him. He's actually a very sincere guy.
Now, in mid-1941, British intelligence fights back.
Lindbergh sits with another man.
So the British are going to set up a secret influence campaign. This is this incredible pivot, and it takes us decades, generations sometimes later, to figure out, oh my God, this is a pivot. That moment, that pivot in the story of the secret world happens in early 1941. When the British go on the offensive in trying to change American public opinion, in trying to push America into the war. And the question would be for William Stevenson, which Americans will help? And how many Americans, if any, do you tell about what you're actually doing, including the President of the United States?
Roosevelt looks at a large globe.
Stevenson gets to work on his disinformation campaign.
The British acquired control of a news agency called the Overseas News Agency, an organization that produced stories that other newspapers purchased. The Overseas News Agency would receive from London or from the BSC in New York an idea for a story, then publish that story as if it had come from one of their correspondents. Of course, it wasn't true. It hadn't come from anyone except British intelligence.
They were really able to use different connections that they had, which really was a foundational part of the BSC itself, starting with Stevenson, his connections. It's important to remember as well that fear sells, subversion sells. The way that that fear is propagated through newspapers was increasing the fact that they were getting readership, that they were able to reach more people.
And it was a very professional system of disinformation, creating the image, the impression of a reality that was completely made up.
A man uses a typewriter while a woman talks on the phone behind him. In a reception hall, a group of jazz musicians play instruments. A woman sits next to a radio.
Stevenson next turns his attention to radio.
The British also wanted to shape broadcasting. And they did it in two different ways. First of all, they had an intermediary to Walter Winchell.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, winds up another edition of the Jurgen's Journal. And until then, I remain your New York correspondent, Walter Winchell.
Winchell is the most popular radio commentator in America, with 20 million listeners nationwide.
Winchell talks into a microphone.
One of the most important sources of the BSC's power was its ability to plant its stories in front of Walter Winchell. The other was to help along the development of international shortwave radio. That's the kind of radio that you would broadcast from the United States, and it could be heard in Latin America or Europe.
It appears to be an American radio station if you're twisting the dial and listening to the news, but it has the British point of view. So it subtly influences American listeners to be more favorable to Britain.
And thus, before you knew it, fake news would find itself to more and more reputable platforms, and thus would seem to be a confirmed bit of information. It's faster when you have social media. But the logic, the philosophy is exactly the same as what William Stevenson implemented in 1941 out of New York.
That was Timothy Naftali.
With the BSC propaganda systems in place, Stevenson sets his sights on Lindbergh.
In a car, Stevenson reads the newspaper.
The BSC uses its various platforms to push the line that Lindbergh is an American because he accepted these Nazi medals in 1938. That Lindbergh is not promoting American interests, he is actually a crypto-Nazi. And that campaign goes into high gear.
We must turn our eyes and our faith back to our own country before it is too late.
Lindbergh addresses a crowd of supporters.
Franklin Roosevelt believes Charles Lindbergh was a Nazi. Hoover and the FBI are very much looking into Lindbergh. And this accusation that he is a Nazi and his role in America's first role, there ends up not being the evidence there that he actually is a Nazi agent.
The effect of propaganda that reminded people of his closeness to Nazi Germany hurt not only Lindbergh's reputation, but his cause. It tainted the concept of isolationism as a purely American form of political expression. That's what the British were trying to do.
In his office, Stevenson puts pictures of Lindbergh in a folder, then takes notes.
The next step is to help Wild Bill Donovan to become Roosevelt's chief intelligence advisor and to lead a new U.S. intelligence agency to conduct worldwide secret operations.
Donovan enters Stevenson's office and shakes his hand.
He's nudging Donovan in the direction of heading an intelligence agency. The British are lobbying Roosevelt to create this organization.
So what the British were trying to do was to help Stevenson along with his crusade to make Donovan a key player and to make Donovan Roosevelt's coordinator of information.
In June 1941, FDR summons Donovan to the White House. Wild Bill Donovan now heads America's first civilian intelligence agency with the mandate to watch Europe, laying the basis for what will become, after the war, the CIA.
Mr. Reynolds.
It's a presidential order. So Donovan gets to work in Washington and create this organization. More or less, you know, the British are saying, here's what you need to do. They actually write memos for Donovan, telling him how to staff and how to set it up.
Donovan picks up the phone.
What makes the Donovan-Stevenson relationship a matter of world historical importance is how that country thinks about secrets and fights the secret war in peacetime as well as wartime would matter for the world. Stevenson helped Donovan make a case that America needed an American version of the BSC.
A cannon is fired. On an animated map, the Nazi expansion reaches Eastern Europe.
On June 22, 1941, Hitler shocks the world by launching a surprise invasion of the Soviet Union.
Employing the strategy used so effectively against Poland and the Low Countries, the mission of the opening attack was to discover and destroy the enemy's principal command positions, supply lines, and communications.
A page of the Herald Tribune appears in front of images of the war, then disappears.
The fear of Hitler reaching the American continent is greater than ever.
La Paz, Bolivia.
In May 1941, the FBI asks Stevenson to help investigate the possibility that a Bolivian military attaché in Berlin, Major Elias Belmonte, is part of a Nazi plot to overthrow his own government. Stevenson sends secret agent Montgomery Hyde to investigate the situation in Bolivia. Learning that the FBI's concerns about Belmonte are well-founded but lacking any hard evidence, Hyde proposes to create it.
In Hyde's mind, perhaps you just help history along by creating evidence of it. And so Hyde concocts this plan, which Stevenson approves, which is to craft a message that would be plausibly come from Belmonte to the German minister describing a plot to overthrow the government. But this was an audacious gamble. You had to find letterhead from the Bolivian mission in Berlin. You also needed to figure out how Belmonte signed letters. And you had to figure out a way to expose the letter so that people would believe that the British acquired it without forging it.
With the forged letter ready, Stevenson shares it with the FBI, claiming that a British agent has taken it off a German courier in South America.
Stevenson lengthily stares at the forged letter.
As Bill Stevenson enters this world of fakery, he is taking enormous risks that his allies in Washington are going to turn their back on him. We know that when the FBI gave the letter to the State Department, the FBI told their friends, "We're not sure this is real."
A photo of the White House is shown.
On July 10th, 1941, J. Edgar Hoover sends the letter with a translation to the White House, saying that the president might be interested in it. This letter, which both the State Department and the FBI think is probably a forgery, is passed by the United States government to the government of Bolivia as a real document.
Roosevelt accepts the letter as proof of Nazi intentions in the Americas. Word spreads quickly through the press that the faraway war is on its way to U.S. soil.
A headline reads, "Bolivia attaché in Berlin cited as coup leader."
The British managed to get away with passing off a forged document. Clearly, the president of the United States didn't mind. Bill Stevenson can look at this in two ways. He can say, "Phew, we got away with it," or, "Yes, we got away with it." And his response was, "Yes, we got away with it. Let's do this again."
Stevenson strikes again and quickly, this time at the Nazi-controlled Vichy French embassy in Washington, D.C. Stevenson is an early adopter of the spy tactic called the honey trap.
A woman holding documents sits in the back of a car.
So Agent Cynthia, real name Betty Pack, she is this classic female espionage character. They call her the Matahari from Minnesota. And female spies have a very fascinating history because their femininity is used in the world of espionage in order to obtain secrets.
That was Shannon Nash.
She was seductive and brilliant, and she had a way of getting considerably older men to do things that she wanted them to do, which also happened to be things the British wanted them to do.
With intel from Agent Cynthia and a series of secret wiretaps, Stevenson has what he needs to prove that Vichy France is running a pro-Nazi campaign on U.S. soil.
Mrs. Pack talks with a man at a bar.
Stevenson wasn't reckless. He decided to use his friend Vincent Astor to see what FDR thought of British intelligence making public the information it had. What we know for sure is that Stevenson cabled London saying, "Franklin Roosevelt has read our report and he is giving us permission to give it to the press."
On September 1st, 1941, newspapers across the country reveal the Vichy Embassy's pro-Nazi secret activities uncovered by Stevenson's network.
A series of newspaper headlines is shown.
He wanted the fact that Roosevelt had already seen it, had already approved it, to protect the British government if the State Department and or the FBI balked. Stevenson knew his man. I think that as a result of the fact that the White House swallowed the Belmonte letter, despite the fact that the FBI and the State Department thought that it was probably a forgery, was a signal to Stevenson that he had a friend in the White House.
A photo of J. Edgar Hoover is shown.
Stevenson's triumph goes too far for J. Edgar Hoover, already uncomfortable over Stevenson's successful mentorship of William Donovan, Hoover's rival in the growing U.S. intelligence community.
Stevenson and Donovan climb inside a car.
What makes the FBI uncomfortable with Stevenson is the outrageous nature of some of his activities. When he gets into wiretapping and bugging people's homes and all those sorts of things, he's really on FBI territory and violating American law and operating way beyond what is appropriate for a foreign government within the United States. As far as Hoover's concerned, this has crossed a line.
That was Professor Call.
My fellow Americans, the Navy Department of the United States has reported to me that on the morning of September 4th, the United States destroyer Greer, her identity as an American ship, was unmistakable. She was then and there attacked by a submarine. Germany admits that it was a German submarine.
That was the voice of FDR.
In September 1941, President Roosevelt announces that American ships can fire on German vessels if provoked. FDR says it's because a Nazi submarine has attacked a U.S. destroyer.
A plane flies over a body of water during the war.
He is announcing that he, as commander-in-chief, has authorized a shoot-on-sight order, which will allow American Coast Guard and naval ships to attack German vessels if they felt threatened.
What Roosevelt doesn't say is that Britain provoked the attack.
Aboard a submarine, a group of men stay silent.
To isolationist Americans, the president's position crosses the line.
Water leaks inside the submarine.
There was a sense among isolationists that this had been an incident that had been cooked up by the British and the Americans together. So there's great disquiet in the audience. Because it is clear the president is on the path to war.
America First's famed spokesperson, Charles Lindbergh, has had enough.
Charles Lindbergh.
The danger of the Roosevelt administration lies in its subterfuge.
Lindbergh has just heard the president of the United States escalate his action short of war. He attacks the FDR administration, the British, and the Jews for misleading the American people and for pushing the country into war. He had, in a sense, shot himself in the foot. Newspapers decried the overt anti-Semitism that he now associated with isolationism. He had tainted isolationism in a way that the British had tried to, but he managed to do it himself.
They shout that we are causing disunity.
Lindbergh's stature never recovers, and his reputation as a Nazi lingers to this day, in some part, thanks to William Stevenson.
A photo of Stevenson appears superimposed on video images of Lindbergh's supporters.
Stevenson now runs the largest foreign intelligence operation ever on U.S. soil. And Wild Bill Donovan is picking up tricks from the British spymaster for his own growing operation.
Stevenson and Donovan talk. Shannon Nash.
I don't think that there was puppet strings that Stevenson was holding operating Donovan in any big way. Stevenson sees someone who also gets it. He sees someone who understands that America needs to come into the war. He sees someone that understands that Britain needs help in a certain way, and almost the future to some of this warfare that's needed. And the efficiency and effectiveness of the type of warfare that Stevenson is doing, Donovan also understands that.
Churchill and Roosevelt shake hands on a ship's deck.
At the top of the pyramid, you have the working relationship between Roosevelt and Churchill. But over in intelligence, you have this working relationship between Bill Donovan and William Stevenson. If you want to understand how Britain and the U.S. could work together successfully in the war and successfully in peacetime, you need not only to look at the convergence of political systems, but in the working relationships established during the war years between particular British figures and particular Americans.
But the power wielded by the two Bills, Little Bill Stevenson and Big Bill Donovan, draws jealousy and concern, especially from J. Edgar Hoover.
One of the things that makes the FBI incredibly uncomfortable is the realization that BSC is operating a spy network within the United States whereby certain Americans are gathering intelligence on other Americans and passing it to the British. And there are a number of prominent Americans who are investigated by BSC, including a State Department official called Adolf Burley, looking for dirt so that he could be discredited in the American media.
Hoover asks the State Department to help shut down Stevenson's operations. The State Department appeals to the president. But FDR needs his secret interventionist network. In October 1941, Donovan advises Roosevelt to let Stevenson continue.
A small group of men in suits gathers in an office.
The State Department had tried to get rid of Stevenson, and it hadn't worked.
Adolph Burl.
President Roosevelt had deferred to William Donovan, and William Donovan needed William Stevenson in terms of the information he had. So when the State Department couldn't get FDR to throw out Bill Stevenson, it begins working with members of Congress to revise the Foreign Agents Registration Act.
Men wearing bow ties play the saxophone in a jazz club. In his office, Stevenson furrows his brow and bites his lip.
Stevenson next decides to deliver an even more provocative piece of fake evidence. A map showing Nazi intentions in the Americas.
Writing appears on a black and white map of South America. Professor Call.
So anything that BSC could do to develop American fears of a Nazi threat to Latin America was incredibly useful. This is like a sensitive nerve that the British poke at throughout 1940 and 41. And of course, the most effective single piece of propaganda around that nerve is the fake Nazi map.
In October of 1941, the British give Donovan, for the White House, a Nazi map of South America. A map which they say they found in Argentina. The British explain that there are three of these maps in the world. Hitler has one, and there are another two in Latin America.
The map was an incredibly sophisticated piece of work. It was overlaid with multiple elements that made it seem genuine, like handwritten notation about German airline routes in a German-dominated Latin America. And there was also something tremendously provocative about Germany moving the boundaries around, merging countries together, awarding sections of the continent to this country, taking land away from that country, creating entirely new countries like New Spain, which seems to replace Colombia. The map was created for an audience of one, that person being Franklin Roosevelt.
When the copy was sent to President Roosevelt, it made a considerable impression upon him because it emphasized that in the event of Hitler winning the war against the European allies, he had plans for carving up Central and South America.
A couple weeks later, the fraudulent Nazi map finds its way front and center into one of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's speeches. And it's not just any speech. This was his Navy Day speech. Important speech for him. Who introduced the President of the United States at a dinner that was broadcast live on radio across the country? Bill Donovan. Bill Donovan, the man who passed the fraudulent map to the president.
Donovan smiles in a photo.
I have in my possession a secret map made in Germany by Hitler's government, by the planners of the New World Order. It is a map of South America and a part of Central America as Hitler proposes to reorganize it. And they have also so arranged it that the territory of one of these new puppet states includes the Republic of Panama and our great lifeline, the Panama Canal. That is his plan. It will never go into effect.
I went back to that Navy Day speech and I looked at successive drafts. And with each version of the speech, he backs away from the superlatives around the map. So to begin with, he says, I have in my possession a secret map of undoubted authenticity. And then the second version, it's, I have in my possession a secret map of a secret and authentic map. And then eventually it just says, I have in my possession a secret map. He certainly sees it as a convenient document which plays to a genuine threat in the world.
And that map, my friends, makes clear the Nazi design not only against South America, but against the United States as well.
So it was an intelligence coup, or an influence coup, I should say, of the First Order. There's no point in being an isolationist, right, if the Germans are going to come and upset the apple cart in America's backyard.
We have to ask whether Roosevelt and his speechwriters knew that the map was a fake. He might have had his suspicions, but I think at some level it doesn't matter. That Roosevelt believes that there's a job to be done, that the United States needs to be more supportive of Britain, and he will take what is available as ammunition in that fight.
The way that we marshal support for particular beliefs is ultimately creating a situation where we circle the psychological wagons by threat. And sometimes real, sometimes fabricated. But once threatened, there's got to be some kind of outlet. I see that kind of dialectic, us versus them, we versus the other, as quite foundational to efforts to propagandize.
I don't think we felt guilty because, after all, we were fighting for our lives, or certainly fighting for the existence of the UK, what used to be the British Empire.
It seems clear that Franklin Roosevelt probably knew it was likely a forgery, but he didn't care. It served his purposes in preparing the American people for war.
The key is that the threat wasn't absurd. So we start to see that something has to be close enough to truth in order to induce that fear. Then from there, it can take on its own narrative and be spun and be that fifth columnists are everywhere, as we saw written by Donovan, postulating that they are everywhere.
A headline reads, Donovan tells how Hitler made fifth column a decisive weapon.
In November 1941, a poll shows 68% of Americans now think defeating Germany is more important than keeping out of the war. A full reversal of public opinion in just 1 year.
Men and women work in a weapons factory.
What happens next will blast Stevenson's delicate spy game to oblivion.
Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. A naval base in Hawaii burns.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Professor Ironside.
After Pearl Harbor, they were all in, because then there was this sort of moment, this kind of organizational moment for American society that they could point to, and they had been attacked at that point, right? Because before, it was distant. The war was somewhere else.
I was working quietly at home, writing a speech for some member of Congress saying we should stay out of war.
Ruth Benedict.
I didn't believe it. I suspected this was a gimmick started by FDR to get us more involved. And I had to get a lot of answers to my questions before I could fully take it in and believe it.
The war that William Stevenson and his team were trying to sell to Americans was a war against Nazi Germany. So in those early moments of December 7, 1941, the British understandably were concerned that it would be very difficult for Franklin Roosevelt to make beating Hitler the number one objective.
A Japanese general and Hitler meet.
Adolf Hitler had promised the Japanese that if they went to war against the Americans, Nazi Germany would declare war against the United States.
So Hitler comes to Roosevelt's aid, as it were, on December 11th by declaring war against the United States.
At night, a car stops in front of Stevenson.
Stevenson, a master of the shadows, must once again reinvent himself and his powerful spy agency.
A man gets out of the car and shakes Stevenson's hand.
Bureaucracies don't argue for their own abolition, but they do embrace new and revised missions to retain their relevance. And that seems to be what happens with BSC, that it repositions itself as an assistance to the United States and a partner in the intelligence dimensions of World War II.
Now that the United States was at war, the things that the BSC, that Stevenson could provide, the Americans had direct means of getting these things. Censorship of letters, or the opening of letters. The United States could now, without violating the U.S. Constitution, start spying on Americans.
And in the New York office alone, more than 2,100 employees must examine some 350,000 pieces of mail each day.
A woman opens a letter with a letter opener.
Even the insides of envelopes are scrutinized for hidden writing by these censors, who began their work the day after Pearl Harbor.
After Pearl Harbor, the State Department ramps up its efforts to take Stevenson and his BSC operation down. In early 1942, a tough act passes through Congress requiring all foreign agents engaged in propaganda to identify themselves publicly.
This new Foreign Agents Registration Bill passes both houses, Senate and the House, and it's presented to Roosevelt. Although we'll never know the extent to which Franklin Roosevelt had his own sort of impression of Stevenson, we know he had an impression of Stevenson's work, and he liked it. It had been useful. In January of 1942, he vetoed a bill from Congress in order to send a signal that he wanted the special relationship in intelligence with the British to continue. At a certain point, leaders, by their actions, resolve mysteries. The BSC had survived. Donovan and Stevenson had prevailed over the U.S. Congress, thanks to Franklin Roosevelt.
Stevenson and Donovan understand they are under intense scrutiny. They must be more careful. The British spymaster's network can only survive if protected by Donovan's American agency.
In a reenactment, Donovan sits across from Stevenson.
Stevenson and Donovan start to prepare a handoff of Stevenson's agents to the coordinator of information. This is totally unprecedented, that an American organization is going to give cover to British spies in the United States. They become American spies, but the British also are still allowed to run them. The handoff doesn't involve a complete severing of relations between the BSC and agents.
Betty Pack rides in a taxi.
Agent Cynthia is once again called from the shadows. In a daring operation, she cracks a safe at the embassy of pro-Nazi Vichy France.
Agent Pack turns the dial of a safe.
So it's very much a spy thriller of seduction and motives of helping the good cause by literally cracking the safe.
The safe contains the code books used by the Vichy Navy to communicate with Nazi Germany.
Pack takes a leather pouch out of the safe.
And it became clear that they didn't have the facility to copy all of them. And so they got the FBI's cooperation. We know that the FBI laboratory assisted making copies of the French codes that the Stevenson-Donovan operation secured.
The code books prove critical to decrypting communications between France and Germany. That secret information gives the Allies crucial intel to help plan the invasion of French North Africa in November 1942.
Soldiers storm a coastal town.
So Donovan and Stevenson decided to keep a big secret from Franklin Roosevelt. Donovan was an American. His team was American. But he was allowing another foreign intelligence service to run agents on his behalf in the United States.
J. Edgar Hoover's FBI has had enough. Stevenson doesn't see it yet, but his downfall has begun.
Timothy Naftali.
The intelligence services were trying to figure out what would be acceptable behavior by the British. All of them agreed, including Donovan, that the British could not ostensibly be in charge of their operations anymore.
Donovan writes in a notebook.
In June 1942, President Roosevelt transfers Donovan's COI to the military, renaming it the Office of Strategic Services. Donovan is reinstated as colonel, but retains his direct link to Roosevelt, centralizing his covert operations in the style of Stevenson's BSC.
Men carrying boxes and folders enter Donovan's office.
He doesn't necessarily need the tutelage of Stevenson to understand it, but he's able to apply it to an American context. He's able to apply it within the COI and eventually the OSS, and he really lobbies for that to continue post-war. He understands that people should be able to have that centralized intelligence operate during peacetime. Donovan sees the value of that.
One of the behavioral patterns learned at the birth of the U.S. intelligence community was that sometimes the intelligence community knew better than the president what was in the interests of the United States. That's not a good lesson to learn. And that was, in a small way, but still significant way, one element of the way in which Bill Donovan and Bill Stevenson handled the changing fortunes of both the BSC and Donovan's OSS after the first part of 1942.
There we go. As we tie the two.
Yes, well, they have very similar moustaches. You can tell.
The war ends in Europe. VE Day, May 8th, 1945. Crowds celebrate in the streets of New York.
Throughout the world, throngs of people hail the end of the war in Europe. It is 5 years and more since Hitler marched into Poland. Years full of suffering and death and sacrifice. Now the war against Germany is won.
A coffin is pulled by horses on a cart.
Following Roosevelt's death and the end of the war, President Harry Truman disbands the OSS and sidelines Wild Bill, who the new president does not trust. 2 years later, the CIA is born. Stevenson's days as a spy chief in the U.S. are numbered.
As the war in Europe was winding down, Stevenson basically wanted a statement of what had been achieved.
Stevenson seems to be concerned about legacy, and he wants to make sure that his war effort and BSC is remembered as favorably as possible. A kind of authorized history documenting everything that the operation had been up to during the war.
The history is an attempt to keep alive Stevenson's philosophy of how to operate in the secret world. It's also a vanity project because it's clearly an attempt to argue that the BSC was worth the effort. Because one of the consequences of the BSC was an American approach to intelligence, which was the most professional in American history.
Stevenson, born in the shadows, reinvents himself again. He moves the legacy writing operation to Canada. Stevenson's hand-picked team of writers work from a highly classified base of operations called Camp X, one of the war's best-kept secrets.
A man carries boxes out of Stevenson's office.
Stevenson wanted the wartime material all to go to Canada so that the writers could look at it, could use it, and then he, Stevenson, could decide what happened to it. He was not going to let Britain decide what happened to the archives generated by his organization.
Stevenson reads a document in his office.
Stevenson read drafts of the history. He had to approve every page of the history. Stevenson had created this incredible achievement. Stevenson had been an architect, one of them, of the special relationship. It wasn't really in his interests for records of minor, maybe, betrayals of lies to find their way into the open.
Stevenson holds a notebook of the BSC.
For his achievements in World War II, Stevenson is knighted at Churchill's request. The following year, he is awarded the U.S. Medal of Merit, presented to him by his friend Wild Bill Donovan.
In a photo, Donovan pins a medal on Stevenson's jacket.
And with that, a man born in the shadows returns to them once more, and he leaves British intelligence for good.
Boxes are taken out of a warehouse.
He instructs his remaining staff to burn the BSC archives at Camp X. But the official BSC history somehow survives.
Documents burn in a fire. In color footage, an old man is helped out of a car.
Stevenson moves to Bermuda. Decades pass.
A white-haired Stevenson holds a cane.
For a number of years after World War II, Stevenson seemed content with his life's work being contained in a volume in a lockbox. But after his stroke, Stevenson became interested in getting his story out.
Stevenson hires Montgomery Hyde to write an authorized biography published in 1962 as The Quiet Canadian. The book, which tells some but not all of Stevenson's exploits, achieves little fame for Stevenson.
The red book cover is shown.
14 years later, a second biography, A Man Called Intrepid, flings Stevenson for the first time into the international limelight, but draws attacks about its wild inaccuracies from others who risked their lives in the shadows.
London, 1984.
The next generation of historians faces the task of separating truth from fiction.
The British Royal Guards ride horses in London.
In 1984, H. Montgomery Hyde invited me to meet him for tea. Hyde had run some of BSC's secret operations, and he'd been close enough to Sir William Stevenson to write an authorized biography. And Hyde revealed to me that he had kept documents. And he was willing to share those documents with me. And Hyde said to me, you know, you should meet Sir William. And so later that year, 1984, I went to Bermuda and I met Sir William. Well, I started asking him questions and he was incredibly amiable. But Sir William, in 1984, had no independent recollections of the great work that he had done in World War II. It was sad because in his effort to control history, he became a prisoner of the lies that he could no longer remember. That's the ultimate tragedy of a figure who had a powerful and largely positive effect on world events.
Stevenson watches the BSC documents burn.
We're 80 years from these events, but they are still relevant today. The spy game, deception, layers of secrecy shape the secret world to this day.
Stevenson dies in Bermuda in 1989, decorated and honored by Britain, the U.S., and Canada. A life that begins and ends in the murky shadows. Yet his legacy lives on.
Nicholas Reynolds.
Do we look at Stevenson as somebody who manipulated the United States to get into World War II, or do we look at him as somebody who helped to save Britain from Hitler? If I were operating in at that time, my primary consideration would have been to save Britain. And to defeat Hitler.
So was Britain responsible for the creation of America's, in inverted commas, deep state? Did Britain destroy the innocence of America and teach Americans how to spy on their own citizens and how to manipulate the world? Some of the things that he did, I think, should be a warning to us. They sailed very close to the wind.
The idea of unelected officials doing things without the approval of elected officials really does present some interesting quandaries for a democratic society, because, of course, these are supposed to be popular, mandated governments. I mean, I suppose the defenders of the necessity of this would argue that they're doing this to protect democracy because they're trying to make sure that people continue to have their nice lives, they continue to have their safe lives. And so do people need to know about everything in order to go about their lives? Maybe not. But this can really go off in a very dark direction very quickly.
Stevenson's blind spot is that he didn't think about the consequences of political warfare for democratic societies.
January 6th protest images are shown.
Since the end of the Cold War and the creation of social media, there is once again the question of the vulnerability of democratic societies to political warfare by outsiders. Political warfare also by insiders, too. William Stevenson helped create a weapon for shaping democratic opinion. He saw the benefits in a time of black and white, but he didn't fully understand the consequences in a world of grays.
That was Shadow Man, directed by John Lecuyer, written by John Lecuyer and Eric Sabag, produced by Kenneth Hirsch, narrator Peter Outerbridge, a PMA production, Gebreiter Beats Film production, a Leonine company, Described Video Set Incorporated 2024.